It's exciting to have you here. This is Angela Pyle from University of Toronto, and she's going to talk to us today about play in early childhood. And so I thought I'd just throw out the hardest question first. What is play?
I think that is a hard question because play is so many things. It is encompassing sort of children interacting together for pleasure and joy and just the natural expression of children's beings. But it can also be a tool that we can use to support children's learning in a really developmentally appropriate way, especially for our youngest learners.
I know that you've done some really critical work on something that you call the continuum play. And I think that would be really helpful for you to talk through to get a deeper understanding of how you're looking at it.
I think the continuum of play is so important because it allows teachers to understand that there are particular types of play that happen in classrooms at different times for different purposes, and that they are all welcomed and important versions of play. At the one end of the continuum, we have teacher-directed play, which allows us to be very targeted in the learning goals, particularly in the area of academics. Teachers can really structure that kind of play in a way that ensures that children learn particular targeted learning skills or academic skills, but in a way that is still playful and developmentally appropriate.
Can you give an example of that?
Absolutely. So, for instance, at this time, you might want to play a math game that allows children to practice one-to-one correspondence, for instance. So they'd be rolling a die and then counting out the number of pieces. Children can be practicing their skills of subitizing by looking at the die or automatically recognizing a number of dots. And they can be practicing moving their piece along the board in a way that ensures that they have one-to-one correspondence and can do that accurately. And so that kind of tightly controlled activity is still really fun and playful for children, but it does allow more control over the kind of learning that's happening.
Okay.
At the opposite end of the continuum completely, we have child-directed free play.
Okay.
This is the kind of play where we allow children to be more imaginative and more creative. We give them the space and the time to explore ideas together. This is the time when children learn how to socially negotiate in the context of play. So we often hear conversations that start with who's going to play what in the context of play.
But I don't want to be the dog.
Exactly. And then we can have conversations about why can't there be more than one mom in this context of your play? And they can do that sort of negotiation that happens, which I think is really important to understanding how to get along in a classroom and in the world at large. I also think, and we know from research, that free play allows for the development of important skills like self-regulation. So for children to understand that when they don't get their way in play, to be successful in that play and to be still welcomed by the other children, they need to control their emotional reaction to whether or not things go their way and make a decision. Am I going to let that go so that I can be a participant in this play, or am I going to get very upset, in which case I'm probably going to be socially isolated from that play? And so that kind of decision making really helps with the development of self-regulation. And then we have this lovely middle ground of play where both the educators and the children can be in charge of what's happening. We would call this typically collaborative play, and that's where we develop a context of play that has targeted learning goals, but also has the freedom for children to explore, be creative, use their imaginations, and also still have that social problem solving and self-regulation. So this is like that lovely happy medium. One of the examples I love to give is of a veterinary clinic that was developed in a classroom where children are working with their stuffed animals, pets, to sort of diagnose and solve their problems. And there are a lot of negotiations that happen. For instance, one day we have two children and a giraffe, and one has determined the leg is broken and the other is determined it's not. And really, in order to figure this out, an educator does step in and give them some advice about something that would be done in a real veterinary clinic and says, have you ever heard of an x-ray machine?
Okay.
The children get very excited about this concept of an x-ray machine. They use the iPads to learn more about it. What does it look like? What does it produce? And then the children actually construct their own, make their own replicas of x-rays, ways, label all these pieces, create instructions for them, and now we have this lovely integration of literacy from the educator coming in and thoughtfully intervening in this play, along with all the opportunities for social negotiation and self-regulation that come from the context of free play.
Sure. Being part of a teacher education department, there are a lot of questions about how we go about supporting both pre-service teachers who are mm-hmm. learning to teach and in-service teachers who are in the field to use play-based instruction. And that can be challenging at times. And one element that shapes their practice is their conception of play. And I know that's a critical idea in your research. Can you talk about how that shapes their engagement in play-based instruction?
Absolutely. Almost every research project we've done has involved first analyzing and asking about teacher perspectives of the mm-hmm. purpose of play in their classrooms, and then looking at the actual implementation of that play within their classroom spaces through observation. And what we find every single time is when educators have a particular conception of play. So mm-hmm. for instance, an educator who has a limited, restricted conception of play as just traditional play that is child-directed, imaginative, with no end goals, and that is the only version of play mm-hmm. that they can imagine and that they describe, those teachers really then tend to only implement that type of play in their classrooms. Right. All of the play is free play, and educators remain uninvolved in that play. When educators have wider notions of play and mm-hmm. believe that they can be involved in it still play, that they can direct some of it in a playful way, and also that there is value to children directing their own play, that is what we see in their classrooms. We see a variety of different types of play and a variety of different teacher interactions in the context of that play. So I think it's really important because of our desire to ensure that children develop socially, emotionally in mm-hmm. the early years, and also that they develop these academic skills in the early years, then I think it's really important that we do have these multiple forms of play mm-hmm. in our classrooms. So I think it's important that we get an understanding and help our pre-service teachers and our in-service teachers gain an understanding of their own preconceived notions of what play looks like and should look like in a classroom. And once we understand what these notions are, we can learn how to extend their notions of play in order to bring in more of a pedagogical approach to play instead of a purist approach to play. And I think that's really important. I think the lovely thing about using something like the continuum, and it doesn't have to be that exactly, mm-hmm. but understanding notions of different types of play really allows multiple entry points for educators. Mm-hmm. So if you are coming at this from a very child-directed sense and you are really attached to that way of thinking about mm-hmm. play, that's still a great starting point. Mm-hmm. You can look at that free play end of the continuum and then take sort of baby steps in. Maybe mm-hmm. I can bring in a little bit of inquiry where I take something I see in the children's child-directed play and I can build on that and insert some of the learning goals that I'm hoping for them in that sort of context, which I think would be really valuable. If, on the other hand, I'm coming at the play continuum from a very teacher-directed, I would prefer to have my students sitting at their tables and doing their work independently. A structured play activity would feel like a more natural extension of that, and that can be the entry point that feels more comfortable. And I think the most important thing is that we're just trying to get teachers to experiment with these different types of play so they can see the benefits for their own learners, and wherever your entry point is will work just fine as long as you're willing to step along the way.
Okay. Now, I've heard you talk about small shifts.
Yes.
Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, we do like to talk about small shifts because the reality is the practices that we're using are often really excellent. Mm-hmm. And tiny tweaks to things that we're already doing can have great gains for students. So for instance, if we're in a really teacher-structured environment where the play is really teacher-directed and we sort of have a lot of constraints on that play, one of the things we can just start is by making this small tweak of allowing children a little bit of agency and choice. So could I start, for instance, by still having having them play my game, but I can let them choose the manipulatives that best serve their purposes, mm-hmm. or let them express their learning in a way that is most representative to them. So would they rather draw that for me? Would they rather write that? Would they rather show with manipulatives? And that kind of choice can give the children some agency, mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. also give the educator some experience with letting go of control a bit. Mm-hmm. And that way we can move towards a more playful approach where we give some sort of structure to the play, but allow children to control the imaginative piece within, okay. which would be sliding along the continuum a little bit okay. further.
When I have talked to educators about the continuum of play, the question that always comes up, what's the best kind? Mm-hmm. What should I say?
I know, I do hear that question a lot too, actually. But the reality is there's no single best kind. Mm-hmm. The best kind for that moment and that child is going to be based on the learning goals. Mm-hmm. So is your student struggling with self-regulation and their ability to sort of socially negotiate in your classroom? Mm-hmm. That student's actually going to benefit more from child-directed free play and more opportunities to interact socially with their peers. Mm-hmm. If a student, on the other hand, is struggling with some learning goals and some standards, and you know, for instance, they don't know any of their numbers and I really need to work on that, and that's your learning goal, then the other end of the play continuum is more appropriate. Mm-hmm. and allows you to really focus on the targeted learning that you need to help them develop and support. Yeah. On the other hand, when it comes to bringing all the pieces together, the collaborative play in the middle can be really useful to sort of support students who both need help in terms of their social-emotional development and need help in terms of some academic learning. But it there are some limitations in the sense that it doesn't allow you to be as focused on the academic as a teacher directed. Okay. So. I mean, depends on the
It depends.
Yeah. There's no right answer and no wrong answer to that one.
Okay. How should we support teachers navigating the different roles they have to take in play?
Mm-hmm. I think that is really one of the most challenging mm-hmm. questions. As I think learning when and how to respond to children in the context of play is a really difficult piece to teach. One, I think teachers need to have very solid content knowledge. They need to feel really comfortable in their knowledge both of the standards or expectations that we have of our students, and also they need to feel comfortable in understanding how children develop certain mm-hmm. concepts, such as mathematical concepts, for instance. When we are feeling very confident in that knowledge, we can recognize it in the context of the play. We'll notice it, and then we can actually do something about it. We can ask a really thoughtful question that extends or deepens a child's understanding, that prompts them to play in a slightly different way that allows them to explore a new concept or understanding. So I do think it's very important that not only do we understand notions of play, but we also understand the content that we're trying to teach.
Yeah.
I think that one of the things, because that's a big ask, right?
Oh, right, for real.
And we do talk about small shifts. We talked about that earlier in this podcast. So I will say that one of the small shifts we can make is to start to be planful about the kinds of questions that we can ask mm-hmm. students. So if you need to, even having a sort of small list of questions in your pocket that you can pull out and say, okay, I'm going to try asking this child this question.
Yeah.
Even if it's a question that's as broad as, tell me what you're doing right now, how did you make that decision, that will allow you to get a better understanding of what the child is thinking and what they're experiencing, that then maybe will tweak you to be able to ask a more thoughtful content question.
Right. Mm-hmm. So that really points out the fact that being a fabulous play-based teacher is actually a very intentional and planful activity.
Absolutely. I think you really need to be a keen observer and a keen listener to your students mm-hmm. while being knowledgeable in what you're hoping your students will achieve. And you really do need to be thoughtful about where are you going to position yourself in the classroom, what play environments or play context within your classroom that day do you feel have the most potential for you to extend or build on. Do you have a particular focus? If my focus is on something like measurements, and that's what we're learning about, it would really be a wise decision for me to position myself close to the building or constructive center, for instance, mm-hmm. as there will be some really good opportunities for me to use that knowledge and build on what the children are using, and also a chance for me to assess whether or not children are transferring the information I'm giving them in other contexts mm-hmm. into their play, and are they actually using the terminology? Could I plug in and say, oh, that looks like you've built something symmetrical, so I can give them additional exposure to that sort of subject-specific vocabulary, for instance.
Okay. Another question that comes up is, how do we know when to step in? and when to hold back.
Mm-hmm. That is a really challenging piece. I mean, I think we do get to know our students and know how to approach them based mm-hmm. on sort of their preferences and personalities. Mm-hmm. But I think an important part of that actually is, I would say that you should be motivated to always ask the question or always interact in some way with your students, but really to be responsive of how they answer that attempt to enter their mm-hmm. play and be respectful of that. So sometimes students will make it very clear to you that they are not interested in you extending or modifying their play in any way, shape, or form. And I think as an educator, you need to learn to accept that. This is not the moment. They are not in the right headspace. They are mm-hmm. not feeling like having their thinking built on at that moment. And that's okay.
Yeah.
And then to move on to a different location. I think listening to how your students respond is the key to making that decision.
Okay.
And I think when you're first experimenting with this, it's you're going to get more rejections than
yeah.
acceptances. And I think you just have to be okay with that mm-hmm. and understand, you know, I tried. And there is actually the possibility that your question, while they might not have wanted to answer you, actually did prompt their thinking. So mm-hmm. a bit of observation from a distance to see if actually you did make the change before you believe that that was all for naught is a really important skill. That's that important part about observing and listening.
So it's the teacher has to remember that it's not about her.
Yes. No, it is not about the teacher at all.
Mm-hmm.
The educator is merely there to see if they can lead them along. I think that being said, because the follow-up question I often get to that is, what if you have students who never let you enter?
Mm-hmm.
And I think, well, then you need to be a little bit more determined in
Aha.
your approach, maybe.
Okay.
And I think for those students, sometimes the rejection comes from the belief that what you're trying to do is manipulate or shift their play,
right.
because all you're doing is stopping by to ask a question. And I often find for those particular students to enter the play first, and then from inside the flow of that play to listen to what's happening, and then as a participant of that play, offer a suggestion that will extend the play.
Okay.
So sometimes it's all in our approach.
Yeah.
Some students are just fine if we pop by and ask a question or extend thinking, and some students really are pure about their own play and
mm-hmm.
dedicated to what their plans are, but entering from a position of a participant can allow you to shift that play in
okay.
a way that's powerful.
One of the tensions that I particularly work with pre-service teachers is whether you start your planning with the standards, you know, where you want to go, or with the child, as in where they are. How do we support teachers to navigate this tension in play?
Yeah, I think that is a particularly challenging piece, negotiating mm-hmm. that balance between developmentally appropriate practices and the standards that are imposed on our students from the day they enter the classroom.
Right.
I mean, I think it is really important that we know and have an understanding of the standards
mm-hmm.
and what our ultimate goal is for most of our children.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that because we talked earlier about those incremental steps, I believe in incremental steps for your practice, but
right.
also incremental steps for your children in your classroom.
Okay.
So we really do need to understand, in terms of that end goal, where is their thinking right now? Where is their understanding right now? Sort of no point in jumping all the way to the end before we understand what the beginning is.
Mm-hmm.
And then working with the students sort of incrementally to add to their conceptual understanding, I think. So I'm going to say that for me, we have to start from where the child's at with an understanding that we have an end goal in mind,
mm-hmm.
but also an understanding that from a developmental perspective, not every child will achieve every standard every year, because that's not possible.
Right.
And we also have to acknowledge that, especially in the early years, there's a great difference in children's learning in school settings, especially dependent
yeah.
on when their birthday is,
mm-hmm.
et cetera. So, I mean, there's a good possibility that a child is 11 months younger than another
mm-hmm.
child in that class, and thus developmentally it's completely reasonable that they don't achieve the same standard.
Or another child would be a year older than that, more than a year older. They can be up to almost 2 years older.
Absolutely. So in order for us to sort of accommodate for that and really
yeah.
understand, we have to be willing to be a bit flexible in what we call our curricular stance.
Mm-hmm.
So yes, we should look at the curriculum document and understand the importance of expectations and standards, and I never think that we should ignore that.
Mm-hmm.
But on the other hand, I think we need to be flexible based on where our students' starting
yeah.
points are and help them get as close as they are capable in that point
mm-hmm.
in time in their development.
Okay. So how do we create spaces for teacher engagement in play to support social emotional development? Because I can remember as a starting teacher in the prehistoric age, that there was actually strong belief that you don't teach social emotional skills. It comes out of maturation. But I think we know a lot more now.
Yeah.
So how do we help teachers make the most of that?
I think that there are obviously some skills that we get better at with practice, mm-hmm. but the reality is we wouldn't expect a child to teach themselves how to read.
Right.
So why should we expect a child to entirely teach themselves how to self-regulate, for mm-hmm. instance? And I think we actually are far better at our pre-service level at teaching our teacher candidates about how to teach subject-specific content
right.
matter.
Yes, yes, yes.
But we actually have very few courses and very little information in terms of social-emotional
right.
development for
yep.
children.
Yep.
And I think it would behoove us to have some strategies that are slightly more concrete
mm-hmm.
that we can use as starting places to build on with our
okay.
students. So, for instance, I'm thinking back to some of the classrooms that we've been in. We actually, in our observations during our research, have seen very few incidences of social and emotional development, unfortunately. But I do think it's actually an important skill. So those few classes where we have seen this happening, we're hoping to share that knowledge with our educators and have them build on this. So, for instance, in one particular classroom, we saw an educator who helped children notice their physiological reactions and what their bodies felt like when they were starting
okay.
to reach a point where they could no longer
yep.
control their emotions
mm-hmm.
and their sort of state of being. She talked about it in terms of a car engine revving, and if your motor is revving really high, what can you do? And then what she did was taught the children some very concrete mindfulness strategies mm-hmm. about how to calm yourself down. So counting backwards, deep breathing, and she also used a strategy called the pretzel, where she tightened her body up really, really tight, and then loosened it very slowly, which helps with relaxing. Isn't it wonderful? It honors the fact that you do tend to tense a lot
mm-hmm.
when you're very upset about something, and teaches you how to sort of relax in a guided way. The lovely thing about presenting multiple strategies is there's no single strategy that's going to work to calm
mm-hmm.
you down. And no single strategy that's going to work for all children in your classroom.
Yep.
So providing sort of a menu of choice
mm-hmm.
Allowed children to choose something that would align with what they were feeling at that moment
mm-hmm.
and respect their agency in the
mm-hmm.
moment
mm-hmm.
and not dictate that they must calm in a certain way by a certain point in time. I think the other thing that's important is we've done a lot of work right now in inserting mindfulness into classrooms,
yes.
which I think is really wonderful. But we need to remember that that has to be explicitly connected for our children, especially our youngest children,
yes.
to the emotions that we're experiencing
mm-hmm.
and feeling. And understanding when it would be appropriate. It's lovely to have a mindfulness time that allows you to sort of have a brain break, etc. But they have to understand how and when to use those when their capacity for rational thought is lessened by high emotional stakes.
Yes.
And also, I think using resources that can help students, a visual resource rather than hearing someone speak to you over and over again when you're already worked up, having a visual resource that you can look at and calm yourself down and make a choice. So, for instance, this teacher who talked about engines revving would show them a visual that showed them that their engine was revving, so you could actually manipulate the little speed dial up quite high.
Mm-hmm.
And then there were three visuals at the bottom of the card that represented the deep breathing, the counting backwards, and the pretzel strategy. And then the child would just see that, and the educator would just sort of motion for them to make a choice. And
okay.
that way, you're not adding further stimulation to that
right.
child by using your voice and a lot of actions, because that can actually further exacerbate the situation.
Yeah, sure, sure.
Mm-hmm.
So what do you think the next frontier is in play, both in teaching and research?
Oh. That's a really good question, actually. I mean, for me, what I'm really interested in next is we have all these sort of recommendations based on laboratory-based work.
Mm-hmm.
I'm really primarily interested in the translation of that into sort of reality, I call it. Like, how do you do something that is getting amazing results based on like statistical analyses when one person works with one child
yes.
in a laboratory setting, and that research is so incredibly valuable in informing our thinking. But how do you make that happen in a classroom where there's potentially 30 plus children and 1 to 2 educators?
Yep.
So things like the guided play piece, how can we expect an educator to thoughtfully notice things happening in the context of their classroom, name those things, extend and interact, but also have some more purposefully designed guided play settings. How do they manage their time? How do they manage themselves within the flow of the play? And how do they teach their children how to manage their own needs within that play give themselves the freedom to be doing all those pieces? So I think the negotiation of all those roles is really quite critical to our understanding, because a classroom setting is just so complex. But I think also the notion of multiple types of play and that question that we're constantly being asked about how much of each should we integrate, I don't think there's a singular answer for that. But I do think that there are probably better options for better learners.
Okay.
So, for instance, I'm going to say that children from varying backgrounds have varying needs. For instance, children who are not neurotypical, for instance, play is not actually sometimes the ideal context for them to learn their academic skills, because the play itself presents enough of a challenge. I think for children from various socioeconomic backgrounds and different cultural backgrounds, we have other layered challenges because of expectations of learning environments and what those should look like. So I think the next piece is to really explore how the implementation of varying types of play in the classroom impacts the learning of different types of learners and different types of environments based on different learning goals.
Okay.
For me, that's the next interesting question. But I mean, I think there are a million interesting questions possible.
But that one's pretty interesting. Well, thank you, Angela. It's been a pleasure talking to you. And let's do it again.
Great. Thanks so much for having me.
Okay.